Today is July 24th, 2014. My name is Kelsey Bovell, research assistant and master's student at IUPUI. Today I have the privilege to be interviewing Ms. Kate Voss in a conference room or in her office at Sense Charter School. This interview is part of a larger oral history project titled Voices from Indianapolis Waterways. The purpose of this project is to better understand the changing role of waterways such as the White River, Pleasant Run, Fall Creek, Pogue's Run, and Eagle Creek in Indianapolis. Excerpts of these interviews may also be used as part of a public art installation by Mary Miss, a New York-based artist. Principal investigators for this project are Philip Scarpino, Director of Public History at IUPUI, and Jason Kelly, Director of IUPUI Arts and Humanities Institute. Funding comes from IUPUI Chancellor's Office, the Arts and Humanities Institute, and the Public History Program. We are interviewing Ms. Moss because she is a longtime resident of a neighborhood near Pleasant Run and because she is a community outreach coordinator for Sense Charter School. Sense stands for Southeast Neighborhood School of Excellence and enrolls students in kindergarten through seventh grade. A charter school is a public school that is non-sectarian and non-religious and operates under a contract or charter. Under Indiana Code, charter schools are established to serve the different learning styles and needs of public school students, to offer public school students appropriate and innovative choices, to afford varied opportunities for professional educators, to allow freedom and flexibility in exchange for exceptional levels of accountability, and to provide parents, students, community members, and local entities with an expanded opportunity for involvement in public school systems. Sense was established in 2004 and is located at 1601 Barth Avenue near the Barth Bridge that passes over Pleasant Run. Its mission, as stated on their website, is to nurture academic excellence, social development, and civic responsibility to every individual. More information on Pleasant Run can be found on the recording of Marty Lamar's interviews. So, at this time, Ms. Voss, I would like to ask your permission to do the following. Record this interview, deposit the interview in the IUPUI Special Collections and Archives, as well as the Arts and Humanities Institute for the use of their patrons, including possible posting of this interview or parts of this interview on their website. Use part of the recording in the public art project carried out by Mary Miss concerning Indianapolis waterways. Do we have your permission to do these things?
Absolutely.
Wonderful. Let's get started with a few easy questions. So when and where were you born?
I was born in Youngstown, Ohio, October 21st, 1954.
So how did you end up here?
So my father, and as his father before him, was a steel worker, and he transferred here from Youngstown Sheet and Tube to become a foreman in the mill in Gary, Indiana.
Before you moved to your current neighborhood here, did you live anywhere else?
I lived in Bloomington, Indiana for 20 years. I basically lived out in the woods and just came here about 14 years ago.
What did you do before you were the outreach coordinator here?
Before I was the outreach coordinator here, I was the outreach coordinator for IPS school 114, which is located on Raymond and Emerson.
Okay, so I'd like to take several minutes to ask you some questions to establish kind of context of the neighborhood and the school and its relationship with Pleasant Run for anyone who ends up listening to our recording. So we've established that you moved here about 14 years ago. Where is your neighborhood in relation to downtown?
In our neighborhood in relationship to downtown is that it is just to the southeast of the downtown area. It was the first suburb of Indianapolis, established basically. The great growth was about the turn of the century.
So what drew you to this neighborhood then?
When I lived in Bloomington, as I mentioned, I lived out in the woods. I met my husband, my future husband, and he did not like Bloomington. He wanted to live in Indianapolis, so when I came here, I knew I couldn't live out in the woods. And so I said, well, then I want to be in a neighborhood that is bohemian, urban, and somewhere I can connect with a community. And we investigated some different neighborhoods, and Fountain Square at that time, everyone said it's up and coming. A lot of artists had moved into the area. It was definitely an area where you moved in and people said you were urban pioneers. But the neighborhood had really declined, but we could see great possibilities here.
Do you think you could elaborate on me about what you mean by urban pioneers?
Urban pioneers. This neighborhood was in decline, as I said. Many people attribute that to the freeway being cut through the neighborhood, dividing it from the downtown area. It was known to be dangerous. When I first moved here, I had a baby shower, and some women stood on the front porch, and while their husbands circled the neighborhood, and they, when they felt it was safe enough, they gave their husbands a sign that they could go on. That is the reputation when we first moved into the neighborhood. We had crack houses literally on our street, and the sex industry parade of women were up and down our street as well.
Wow. So was it difficult to get a loan to purchase your home then, since it was in a notorious area?
We are definitely in a redlined area, but we had great credit, and we had deposit money to put down, so we bought this house with great expectations for the neighborhood that we thought was going to be transformed in the next few years that we were here. But the economy tanked, and so things really came to a slow halt.
So when did you see things start to change in the neighborhood?
The neighborhood really started to change. There was many tiers to that. Because people started moving into the neighborhood and on our block that had a like mind, we started banding together. We wanted to stand up and say, we're not going to take it. We are people who have power. And we could be change agents. And so we banded together and we started calling the police. We started making change. And so that was the beginning. People started getting together and making the change in our neighborhood that they wanted to be in. And in that, we were blended into the old school, as we call them, that have been here many years, but they were afraid to come outside. And so I started gardening. And then they started gardening, and then there was waves, and then people sat on their porches, and we had exchanges. But really what turned things around was when the cultural trail came into Fountain Square area. That's when people really noticed that things were turning around. Restaurants came in, boutiques came in, what they called hipsters started really moving in because it was cool here. They could drink, they could play, and there was music, and there were cultural events that really attracted them. And so I think there was a lot of change, and then the bike trail came in, and I think that really changed things as well. We are also noticing a different demographics in the last couple of years is that baby boomers who are retiring are wanting to move into this area. They really don't care about a lot of the amenities, but they want to be in a place where they can walk and ride their bike to wherever they need to be, whether it's shopping or entertainment, and they're very close to the downtown area.
How do you think you can engage those people to have them invest in the area and hopefully in this area as well? Do you think that's possible?
And so there is a movement with some of the young people who want to stay here, they want to invest here, they want to buy, and they want their children to be here in schools. And so we are starting to see where families are coming to our school. We have been established as the old school, where families, we are 97% below poverty for most of our children, but young families are staying. They want to invest in this area. They want to invest in galleries. They want to keep this local. I see urban farms, gardens growing up, And we do things like art parade. We have First Fridays down here. We make it fun, and people want to stay. This has become a destination.
So how did you become involved with Sense?
I live in the neighborhood myself, and the coordinator who was here before became a friend of mine through our community outreach endeavors. And when she left, and she was blessed enough to be able to stay at home with her child, she contacted me and says, there's a position open. Would you be interested? And I said, absolutely. It's my neighborhood.
So what all does your job entail then?
As an outreach coordinator, what I do is I look for programming, funding, and I bring that into the school. I find food donations, clothing donations, backpack donations, and I distribute that to the families. I bring in the arts. I bring in programming that will attract families because that's something unique, because we value the arts and humanities here. And then I get them out to our families. We have a First Friday that we recently organized just so our families feel that they're connected with this, because there's a us in them that is growing with the gentrification that's happening here. And so how do we fold them in and see that they can be part of this as well?
Could you explain what a First Friday is to me?
A First Friday, that was a concept that's probably started about maybe up to 10 years ago, where the galleries in Indianapolis all opened up on the first Friday of the month. And there was a rotation of gallery shows. People came out, they saw, they drank, they ate, they celebrated. And one of the areas that was very strong in that was the Fountain Square area. The Murphy Building, which was an old Murphy's department store, was a center for that, and there were a lot of galleries that came out of that. People for Urban Progress are in there, so people come and enjoy themselves.
Okay, so I'm going to pull us back to the school a little bit more. What kinds of things have you learned about the school in relation to Pleasant Run? How do they use it?
So, the Pleasant Run area is a long stretch of a road on either side of the creek. Excuse me, it's not a creek. We call it a creek. I've been told many times it's a stream. So Pleasant Run stream runs through our neighborhood. There's a lot of foot traffic in this neighborhood. Transportation is an issue, but along the road on Pleasant Run, it's a direct cut through the community that is access to the entire neighborhood. And the creek or stream is an attraction for, of course, for kids and families. There's small bridges that go over it. At the end of our street, where the school is the Barth Street Bridge. It is a footpath now. It is no longer a drivable, but we are working to make that a destination. And so along the stream are places that we are trying to make a destination, make a change, and make some change for the quality of the water that runs in the stream. I don't know what else to say about that.
That's okay. During your pre-interview, one of the things that really stuck with me was when you said that you were trying to make science and art magic for the kids.
Absolutely. So I've been working for a couple years with Reconnecting Our Waterways, ROW, and they are an organization that is trying to bring awareness to the ecosystem of the waterways in the Indianapolis area. I like that mission. It runs through our community. I think that it's important to support that, and I could see that there was great advantages to being part of ROE because they could bring funding in, programming in, and what they'd like to look at is a nice mashup of art and science. And I think that that could be magic for our families. So we're looking at programming. We're going to put a science, outdoor science lab down there. I'm working with people to bring poetry, music, the arts to that location. And I think that it could be a wonderful way to bring the different cultures, the different classes that are appearing in our neighborhood, because this is a common denominator that so many can appreciate.
So you keep mentioning programs.
Yes.
Can you explain that a little bit more for me?
So recently we were fortunate enough to have one of the moms graduate from the IU Center for Earth Science. And I met her at a convention and I said, what? I didn't even know she had this skill. So we started talking about it. I had a 4-H program here. And so she and her department brought in a science bend to the program. The kids enjoyed it. It's a nice variation for some of our kids who don't want to be in glee club. They don't want to be in soccer. They want to be in science. And so having that option was a wonderful opportunity. And I don't think that there's enough emphasis on sciences because we are so caught up in the reading and math. But she was able to bring an after-school program. So we got together and we started thinking, wouldn't it be nice to do it like an eco camp? And so this summer, again, they sponsored an eco camp. We have something called Summer Servings that's free and reduced for all families in this neighborhood. The kids can come and get a free breakfast and lunch. And so I thought, wouldn't it be great if we could offer something to the kids afterwards to give them something to do, to keep them off the streets and keep them engaged. And so for a week we had an eco camp. They brought in all sorts of scientific equipment, they brought interns in, and they worked with the kids, and we went down to the stream every day, and we did testing, and the kids worked on experiments in chemical and biological, and they were able to look at what is in the streams. And this is right in their backyards, and so it gave them an awareness. And it seemed like it was a great success. So we're thinking, let's build on this. What can we do to build on this? So I'm again in conversation with the Center for Earth Science. They're excited about what they're seeing is happening here. I'm working with ROE. ROE was recently given a large grant, the Kresge grant. And so there's funding. I'm on the committee to look at what kind of programming can we bring in. But we have to remember to reach out to the citizens here, reach out to the neighbors, because we can have ideas about what is it that we think is, can be magical here? But what will our families come to? What do they think is important? I might think it might be rock and roll, where our families might want to hear classical, or they might want to hear hip hop. So what is it that would bring our families out and bring them together?
I'm going to latch on to something you said, the Kresge Foundation. So I'm, for the benefit of those who listen later, I'm going to read a little bit about this. Recently, the neighborhood was a recipient of a $211,450 grant from the Kresge Foundation. This foundation is a $3 billion private national foundation that works to expand opportunities in America's cities through grant making and investing in arts and culture, education, environment, health, human services, and community development efforts. The money is currently going to be split between three sites, one at Mapleton and Fall Creek. Then the remaining $121,000 will be shared between two sites along Pleasant Run Creek at Prospect Falls and the Barth Bridge. Now, my understanding is you're heavily involved. So how did your neighborhood actually receive the grant?
And so the neighborhood received the grant because of a few of us really pushed. We wanted this as a location. We wanted this Barth Street Bridge as a site for bringing the funding in, bringing the programming in, and an awareness. And so we went to meetings, we advocated. I know that you've talked to Marty Lamar. She and I have worked together for many years. And there we were sparring, pretending to spar in the back of the room, saying, well, I'm going to get it. No, I'm going to get it. Of course, we're all in this together. She's a wonderful friend of mine. And so when the Kresge grant came up, we all got together and we decided what are the things we wanted to do. We had a community meeting where I went knocking door to door, and got the neighbors out. What do they want to see? Because we always have to be sensitive. This is their neighborhood. This is in their backyard. And so they came in, they had ideas, and we submitted all those. It continues to expand. More people are getting excited about the project. And so when the Kresge grant was awarded, it was yay! But where do we go from here now? How do we implement that? A lot of different ideas. So again, we got down to the stream again and we walked it. What is possible? And education, is, of course, is a big push for me. I have a sister school, an IPS school, which is unusual, that is very interested in also having educational programs here. They are in also within walking distance of this school site. And so we are going to bring together some of our ideas for programming and give it a real ecology. I can see expanding maybe for summer programming as well as throughout the year, and bringing the arts. Butler has been very instrumental as well. They've been awarded funding to bring some of the programming here too. It would just be nice to bring different aspects of both the arts, science, and I could see literacy. There's so many possibilities, and I think that's the beauty of this entire program. And I see it evolving, and more people are getting involved, and they're bringing their vision to it. And I think that's exciting, and it's true authentic demand of the neighborhood, and I think that's important.
So one of the things you said was that it's unusual for a charter school to have an IPS sister school. Why is that?
In the school system, at least in Indianapolis, it is an us and them between charter schools and public schools. We vie for children, the same families, the children, the funding, the resources, and they're scarce these days. And so we have a different bend on that. We work together because we have a common goal. We have what is best for our families, what is best for our children, and how can we bring that together and make that strong. And so we are doing programming together on that. We're working together. I just came out of a meeting where we're doing parent leadership training for our families so that they can have the confidence, the skills to be agents of change as well. A lot of them just need that reassurance and that confidence that they can be something and make change for themselves in their neighborhood, whether it's in their families, whether it's in their faith-based, whether it's in their community. So School 31 and myself, we're working together to make that change.
So do you think this dynamic of vying for resources and sort of things, does that affect your relationship with your IPS sister school?
It does not. I just was over there and we compare notes. What do you have? I don't know. This is what I've got. What do you need? So we can bring that together. And we get excited about certain programs. We'll email each other and say, do you want to go with me? Do you want to get involved in this? Please support me, because I think the old saying, united we stand, is very important. And so she and I together, we're standing united for our families, for our children. And will that dynamic continue if we are no longer in that position? I don't know, but I'm hoping that we are setting a precedent. We are also, much to our surprise, people are intrigued about our common union. And we are finding that people are giving us funding for certain programs because this is an unusual dynamic. And so we are going with it. We found the funding for the parent leadership People said, we want to give you money. We want to support this. And so we're going forward. And I think bringing our families together during this leadership, they're from the same neighborhood. How can they also bond? How can they also network? And how can they then serve as a support for each other after they're introduced?
Wow. Why do you think it is that the dynamic works between the two of you, whereas it has failed in other situations?
I really don't know. I'm certain that there's a lot of different reasons. There's politics, there's ego, there's people who put blinders on, but I can't speak to that. I can't put my energy into why they can't. I have to put my energy into why we can.
Okay, so let's jump back to Barth Bridge then.
Absolutely.
What are the plans that are in the works currently?
And so the plans that are in the works is that we are going to receive funding for a platform that will be right next to the stream at a low point where the staff and children and different organizations can do, whether it is testing, whether it's educational, or we even can envision music being played down by the stream. We have kicked around some ideas of putting large rocks down there that can serve just as a focal point, as an artistic point. And we also can see that as somehow we can utilize that as a gathering point where the rocks become somewhere to sit upon. We are also being rolled into our school, the Da Vinci, let's see, I can't remember, it's the Da Vinci, can I take a pause?
We can't turn this off, but I can add something to the end later.
Okay, so that is a project by Quincy Owens and his partner Luke, where they are assembling a bicoscope, a kabicoscope. And so what it is it's gears, and there'll be colored filters, and people can manipulate the bike, and then the colors, and there's a lot of talk about introducing science into that, and art, into this one public art piece. And so I was recently contacted. They said, would your children be interested in helping to assemble that? What? Of course we would. So we've been in conversation. I have a meeting on Friday with our art teacher. What kind of programming can we put around that where we have this public art piece down there and the kids get involved and they're part of this. There's some ownership of that. I think it's very exciting. That's what I mean. The momentum is growing with this. When sometimes you have something so true and so pure as this, some good things come to it. You open yourself to the universe. Oh, that's old hippie stuff. Sorry. It happens, though. And so that's another, you know, way that the neighborhood can get involved. And then we've talked about expanding that. And maybe could there be some fruit markets down there on the weekends? How do we bring a sense of nutrition in? How do we bring business down there? And then it becomes a focal point again for our neighborhood in a different way that has ever been realized. We were talking about educational pieces again and putting native plants down there with little plaques, educating people that way, just opening their minds to different ways of gardening and looking at the environment. And I also think it's very important for people to know what is in that water. I think it's important for our families to know what's in there because they're down there playing, their children are there. I see fishing lines sometimes thrown into the water. During large storms, sewage is thrown into the stream. The CSOs expel all sorts of toxins into there's runoff from pesticides and the environment. There's from the roads, which are close by, both sides of the stream, there's all sorts of runoff. I want our families to know what's in that. And if they know, then maybe they can be, again, help change and clean up the environment and be proud of that. Where people, I think, look at our neighborhood in the past as just a dumping ground. As a dumping ground because they're poor, they don't care, they're powerless. Let's change that. Let's make that stream clear again. Introducing fish in it and in, you know, recreation, and just a place of meditation and contemplation.
So one thing you mentioned with the platform, is that the area that you're going to consider your outdoor science lab?
That is correct.
So what sort of things will happen with the outdoor science lab that you guys are hoping to happen?
So we have already started that with experimentation. We did a water test for the quality of the water that was there. We've looked at what kind of bugs, what kind of things live in the water, what's the pH balance, what do we need to do to get from this point to having a healthy stream? And I think that that's across the world because our resource for water is becoming very scarce. We have to be, that is very precious for us. And should we not heed what's going on now, we are doomed. And we have future generations here that can be part of that change because we want to perpetuate this human. But we can't. We are on a tipping point. Maybe that's too drastic, but I do feel if we do not heed it now and we don't make examples that are going on in our very backyard, then it could be dire.
So when you do inform the community and the neighbors and they start to realize and get involved, what kind of changes do you hope to see in the neighborhood when you are able to inform them of that sort of thing?
That's really tricky stuff. That's tricky stuff because once we start putting a spotlight on the stream and it becomes healthier, then it attracts more people, people who have money, people who raise the rent in this area, people who become homeowners. That's a positive thing. And yet, for our families, we're already seeing families who can no longer afford the rent. Or they feel disenfranchised because they don't feel like they belong in this neighborhood. They see people with expensive bikes, and they see people with the BMWs, and they see people who have dogs that are not the pit bulls, but they have little outfits on. It's a whole different way of thinking. And so how do we blend those cultures together? How can we live side by side where this does not become a broad ripple, where it's one bar after another and people come down here for pleasure and then they leave, or it's a very young down here and the families who've been here for generations they no longer feel comfortable. How do we blend that?
So I think the word you used earlier in regards to Fountain Square was gentrification.
Absolutely.
How do you think you keep the balance of keeping those families here and still improving the area?
And I believe that that's part of the conversation is when we moved in here, we wanted that gentrification. We wanted that change. And now that we've been here long enough and we have folded ourselves into the community and people who've been here generational have become good friends of ours, we're appalled. We don't know how you stop the brakes on something like this. Economically, things are thriving. Stores are moving in. Restaurants are moving in. We're getting good press. People keep saying to us, this is up and coming. We recently had a picnic in the backyard for my husband's lodge. And I think some of them were kind of intrepid about coming down to Fountain Square. But once they come down here and they see things, some of them wanted to stay and they wanted to go and see what else was going on here. That's an attraction. But how do we keep our families here with affordable housing, with economic growth that is good for not only those who are now moving in, but for our families too. How do we keep the grocery store affordable? These are the kind of things that some of us who have been in the community for a while, community activists, we're having conversations around this. What does it mean? We have an art parade that we've had for years now. More and more people are coming from different neighborhoods because they see it as cool and they see it as fun. Where we started out, it was baby buggies with streamers on it. I mean, it was very down home. How do we keep those families engaged? It's like, again, we go back to the First Fridays. That's why I had a First Friday, because our families were not enjoying a First Friday. They didn't feel like they were part of that. And I had families in the first year we had it. You mean they do this every month? Yes, we do. Come out and enjoy it. But again, it's an us and them.
So you mentioned last time we spoke, besides the Kresge Foundation getting a grant, that a sixth grade science teacher applied to Roe, Reconnecting with Our Waterways, for a $500 grant. Again, for the sake of those listening, the future to this recording in the future, ROE stands for Reconnecting to Our Waterways and is an Indianapolis organization, which is a grassroots initiative designed to reclaim the benefits of Indianapolis's waterways to provide opportunities for physical, human, and economic development. What will that money be used for?
We used it in the spring to conduct experiments. We bought microscopes, we bought slides, we bought water test kits, and we got the kids down into the stream. Well, not literally into the stream, but we got them down to the stream where they could, again, do experiments. And that's what got me thinking about, let's do an eco camp. Let's utilize what's right here in our backyard and experiment on that. And so they went to look what wildlife is down there, what invasive plants are down there, how can we clean it up? And at the very end, there was such a pride, they actually did a cleanup. They pulled out tons of debris and trash, and they made observations about this. And then we started thinking, with all this thing that we're pulling out of there, how can we recycle some of this and make it into art? This could be a statement in itself. And so that's a conversation that we're having as well, not only here, but also at the falls. What is down there clogging it up where we can turn that into a piece of art?
Since you mentioned the falls, what sort of things are they planning to do over there?
The falls was also, as you mentioned, awarded through the Kresge grant, and they are going to be doing visual art down there. They are looking for improvements. I believe that they're getting a water fountain down there, picnic benches. I think that there's, not at this stage, but I think they want to do cleanup. There's some major infrastructure that can happen down there, and so I think that having that spotlight, I think that an awareness, just not only here but there, that people can be of interest and help to make that cleanup. I recently had a conversation with Marty and some of the neighbors as well here. One of the first ideas that people from not from the community, they wanted to put picnic benches down there because they thought that that was a perfect solution, that people would come and that would make it a destination. Well, the neighbor said, absolutely, we don't want the picnic benches. They said, kids will be down there smoking and fucking, and I don't want the picnic benches. That's why you need community engagement. I'm also hearing from some of the neighbors that there's drug use late at night down at the bridge. Those are the kind of things that a lot of white people from the suburbs, they don't want to know about. They don't have any engagement in that. But it happens in this neighborhood. And so in talking to some of the neighbors, some of the fathers have taken some folding chairs late at night. They're putting them on the bridge and sitting there. and they're watching all the activity that's going on, and hopefully, because people feel engaged, they feel part of this, they want to be part of this change, and they're going to stake things out just like we in our neighborhood said, we're not going to take it anymore. We're going to be part of this and get out. So that's the kind of thing that when any kind of initiative, any kind of organization, when they come in, they have to listen to the neighbors. And I believe that there's also some of the similar things that are happening down in Marty's area. There's homelessness. There's drug use. There's general mischief. You have to listen to the neighbors and say, this is realistically what is going on. How can we find solutions?
How do you think people coming in from the outside should engage the community? Because there is that general mistrust occasionally. And how do you engage them in a way that will draw them out to help themselves and their community?
I think like you do with any kind of relationship, you build slowly. You open up the dialogue. You value their opinion. You just don't ask what their opinion is. You need to value that. Because people want to give their opinion, then I think there should be some follow-through. There should be, you're looking at what are their demands. And get them involved. Make them feel part of that process. And it's just not a pat on the head, yes, thank you for talking with us, but getting them involved in committees, bringing them into meetings, and listening to their ideas, and how can we implement some of that. That's part of what we're doing with the parent leadership, is to lift up these families and have them feel that they have the skills, that they can run their own meetings, that they can be part of that change, and that they can then lead whatever that initiative is. It might not be what we think. We cannot come in with preconceived notions. I know what you need. You need a zoo down here. You need a big Ferris wheel. I don't know what that is, but I think getting public meetings together and helping to gauge that, I think that's very important.
One of the things you mentioned to me during your pre-interview was that you were surprised when you became the community outreach coordinator because you thought you knew the community so well. How did you go about getting to know your community better?
I think that was one of the most shocking things when I got this job, is that I took the job because I said, I know exactly what this neighborhood is about. I've lived here for 10, 15 years, and I know what they need. And so when I got into this school, I realized I didn't know anything. I hung out with people that were just like me, who thought like me, who lived like me, and I think a lot of us do that. Getting to know some of our families and the true struggles really made me think I need to open up the dialogue. I take the back streets now. I stop my car. I get out. I have conversations. I go to places that they go. I shop where they shop. I try to be a face out here and be places where they are. And I think that that's really helped me. Am I going to ever be like my families? I don't believe so. But how can I bring my heart and my mind closer to their concerns, to their interests? I think that that's just continuing to have that conversations and to be part of a community that I didn't see before and see it realistically.
So since you're so involved in the community, how do you think they view Pleasant Run Creek Stream?
Yes. Well, it depends on who you talk to, of course. Some have very little awareness that it's even down there. But a lot of them know that their families are involved with going down there. It's a sense of recreation. As a kid, you go down there to play. I'm sure they did generationally, and it cuts right through our entire community. There's been more and more awareness of water quality, and so I think that they're becoming more sensitive to maybe the concerns of the water quality down there. They see that the kids are doing cleanups. And so that, when they come home and they have those stories, I think that that gives a sense of awareness. I also think we are losing some of the oral tradition that is happening along the stream that I think would be important to be captured. I hear from some families that there might be a landfill that ran across Pleasant Run. There were a lot of auto and industry that flowed into the water. We're losing that connection, but what are the beautiful things? What is the history? I hear from some the Indians lived along it. What is the truth? I don't know what that is, but I think that we need to look at that as a sense of history. I think that we need to embrace that. How was it used in the past? And have that pride. Again, that can be a plaque. That could be something that can be an education and something that these families have a pride in because they live in this community. This is part of their history. This is part of their fiber. And I think that that's something that we should embrace. And I think a lot of times in poverty, you would never think putting a plaque up for a sense of history. You wouldn't ever think about embracing the history of a stream that's highly polluted. I think by doing that and looking at the pride that in the past, I think that that will catapult and bring some pride in for the future.
So do you see any connection between a healthy Pleasant Run and a healthy surrounding community then?
Absolutely. I think water quality is vital to our very survival. I think that cleaning up that area, I think will not only bring health, but I also think it will bring a sense of pride that people were part of bringing change to their neighborhood, that they were part of that and that they turn things around for people. So it's a sense of health, I think it's a sense of pride, and I think it's a sense of ownership. And I think that we are looking at the future, and if we know things are thin if we don't do something now. And so people want to be part of that.
So not too far down the stream, there is the now shut down Indianapolis coke plant. For those who may listen in the future, a coke plant is a fuel with few impurities and a high carbon content, usually made from coal. The plant itself is a heavy industrial site that has been the center of a lot of controversy involving pollution in the Pleasant Run area. So what has your experience been with the coke plant?
Years ago, I was a community activist in a neighborhood called Norwood. That is when I worked for another school, 114. A number of our children came from Norwood. Norwood is an interesting community. It was, when I worked in the neighborhood, largely African American, which is unusual for the Southeast neighborhood. And they are directly across from the coke plant. It was at that time when the coke plant was just shutting down, and they were talking about remediation. And so I was very good friends with a woman who I really see as the mayor of Norwood. I worked with her in the community and we started investigating and we wanted to know how much remediation, because if you have a community right across from a coke plant, do you stop at the gates of the plant? Another thing that was happening was that the coke plant was going to be donating land around the coke plant, and they were going to turn it into ball fields or soccer fields, rugby fields. There was a lot of different conversation about what that was. But I, in my suspicion, wondered how much testing had been done for the soil, for the environment that our kids were going to be playing on. And so we started having community meetings. We started pushing back on the coke plant. They have a lot of promises, and they said they were going to have funding, but we knew those gifts came with a price. And so we heard the proposals of the Coke plant, and people started asking questions. People who never asked many questions. People who had been there generationally. And people who never felt like they had any power. People who felt like they could never bring any change. Rose up and they said, "We are questioning your motives. We are questioning your sincerity to clean up the environment, and we are questioning what are some of the proposals to be put into the neighborhood," because they were talking about putting more industry in there. They were talking about putting light industry, and none of that seemed like it was going to benefit the neighbors. It seemed like it was going to benefit outsiders and the Coke plant. The Coke plant, they say that they are a co-op, that we are all in this together. But if you are a co-op, I've never seen any dividends. And so I'm sure they've done good work, and a lot of our families in this neighborhood were employed by the Coke plant. And so on that side, they were employed and they could provide for their families. A lot of that was happening in this neighborhood where there's small industry and people made decent living, and a lot of that has closed. And the Coke plant still sits in the middle of our neighborhood, and because of the result of the cancer rates, supposedly, a school was closed, an elementary school in the neighborhood. Is this true? I don't know. Is it urban legend? Probably. But do we keep a wary eye on them? We certainly do. We're hoping they'll be part of the change. We hope that they will be good partners, but we can't rely on them.
So we only have a few minutes left. So I would love to close talking about the Kids of Sense and the surrounding community. What are some of the ways that Sense is hoping to engage the community in the future?
So when you say community, that's very broad.
The neighborhood, the people in the surrounding neighborhood, or the families of your school.
Absolutely. So we bring awareness to our school and into the community by doing things like First Fridays. We get it out of the school and into the community. We engage people to become part of our board. 50% of the people on our board either work, live, or worship in our neighborhood. We have parents who are on our board, and so we are engaging our community that way, to be part of the policy, the very policy that creates Sense Charter School. We go out into the neighborhood. We go to the plaza for Christmas and we do caroling. We have xylophone concerts down in the Fountain Square area. We show our art at the library. So we engage and give some who gives us some sight of who we are. We also invite people in. Do they want an alternative to the education that's going on in the neighborhood? We aren't for everyone. I'm not going to say that. But we give people in this neighborhood an alternative. The very charter was started by neighbors. Neighbors and people from the community, residents who said that they wanted a change for the education system. And so they banded together. They went to the mayor's office and said, "We want a charter school." We are one of the first charter schools. We're about to celebrate 10 years. We've seen a lot of changes and we see a lot of good things that are happening. So we are open. We have an open policy. People can come, they can tour, and we're seeing some blending of the new people who are coming in. And so we're hoping that we can continue to be a nice balance of the old school families and the new.
So what do you think the impact of educating the next generation will be on Pleasant Run?
I think it is important for our families to be educated about that it's important to be sensitive and how important the environment is. We've taken it for granted. We thought there's a lot of resources that were going to go on forever. And we felt we were masters of the universe and that we could make our impact on the world. And we have found that it has come back and it has not been a good chapter for us. And so in educating our families, hopefully that they will know that history, we don't want to repeat that. And we want to improve it, and that our children are precious to us. And how can we then, knowing what we learned, the lessons, we can then expand into a brighter future? And how can we take those skills that we learned about advocating for change? How can we take those where children become leaders? They can be advocates for change. And they go out into their own community, into their faith-based, whether it is in business, whether it's in their own families, and they can be leaders there and create positive change.
So you've put a lot of time and effort into the school, into the community. In 10 years, what will the school and community in Pleasant Run look like to make it worth all of your effort?
I don't do it for effort. I don't expect to reap any benefits from this. I do it probably not for me, but for the future generations. I'm hoping that people will come back into the core of a city. I think environmentally it makes sense. I'm hoping that there'll be transportation. I'm hoping that people will embrace small pods of cities where they can bike and walk and they can live healthy. And I'm hoping that different classes, different groups can live together peacefully and in a community where there's a mutual respect. They might not always understand each other, but I'm hoping that we can live in a healthy, happy, and peaceful existence. I don't ask for more than that.
So is there anything else that you wish to add to the interview?
What I'd like to say is thank you for coming in and listening to our stories. I think that that's very important. This is an oral tradition down here in this community. We tell stories. A lot of it's not written. Literacy sometimes is an issue, but we can tell the stories. We can keep the history. We can be reminded of the past, and we can look to the future. And so thank you very much for giving us this opportunity.
Thank you for participating. We very much appreciate it.
Thank you.